This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
You deserve a moment to yourself every single day. And a delicious bite of a Keebler Sandies can give you that comforting pause. Take a pause from your to-do list with the melt-in-your-mouth magic of a Keebler Sandies. This magic is baked into simple shortbread cookies by Ernie and the Keebler Elves. So as life continues to fly by, make the most of your me moment. Take a pause and enjoy a Keebler Sandies.
I'm Dani Shapiro, and this is The Way We Live Now. Today is day 112 since we started seeing endless ads for loungewear, and day 56 of this podcast. My guest today is someone I've wanted to have on this podcast from the start. But at the start, 112 days ago, he was pretty busy. And he's still busy, but he thankfully has enough time to catch up with us today. Here's Eric Salk, a physician whose specialty has long been emergency medicine. Eric, thanks so much for joining me to talk about The Way We Live Now.
Very excited to be here.
So I started this podcast as a way of reaching out to others so that we could still gather during this time of social distancing and have windows into each other's lives. So to that end, would you describe for us where you are as we're having this conversation, what you're looking at, like what's out your window, anything about your surroundings?
So I am here in beautiful Northwest Connecticut, and in my home, and just using my bedroom, which happens to have be a little bit quieter, but it's a beautiful day, and I'm surrounded by beautiful natural beauty around here, which is one of the great things about living in this corner of the world.
You and I are more or less neighbors, and it's been such a stark contrast to look out the window at all of this beauty, all this natural beauty, and to be, you know, so hyper-conscious of what's going on in the world around us. But you have a bigger, way bigger window on that than I do, which is really why I wanted to have you on the show. So you've been an ER doctor for a long time, and you've seen a lot. When did you realize that we were facing something huge and unprecedented, at least in our lifetimes?
There were those early rumblings, you know, in the early part of this year, after the sort of holidays, we were hearing about this outbreak in China. In the ER and in the medical world, you know, we're hearing about the same thing that everybody else was. You know, it started to get a little more serious in sort of February, and alarm bells were going off, and you know, people's reaction was sort of all over the map. Many people were becoming quite anxious, and others sort of, you know, taking it in stride and minimizing. And I was guilty of probably both extremes at some point as the information was coming across.
Mm. So when COVID-19 did arrive here, what was the beginning of the pandemic like for you? What were your days like?
Because of where we are, sort of not in an epicenter or a place where people, international travelers, are coming and going, we were our wave hit a little bit later than New York, than Seattle, So we had time to get ready, but in those weeks that we were getting ready, you know, it was pretty anxious. The level of anxiety of uncertainty is the thing that I remember most. And stress levels were running high. We were building out, you know, structures in the parking lot in order to, you know, handle potential hordes of people, and trying to, you know, sort through and sequester those who are less sick and more sick. And we were figuring out plans to, you know, to expand our ICU capabilities and, you know, how to redeploy staff and close down certain services, elective services and stuff. So a lot of that was going on. As the cases started to show up, you know, we had to start getting serious about personal protective equipment and isolation and figure out, you know, routines for testing. And as that progressed, it was a sort of a wild ride. Information changed, you know, new information came out daily, and this was happening so quickly that the usual sort of way that we digest scientific information and studies, you know, it was irrelevant. We, you know, we were using social media, web conferences and blogs of critical care medicine people and emergency medicine people, you know, sort of sharing anecdotal information and early studies. And some of those, you know, the ways that we approached patients in those early days, you know, using the best information we had, you know, and the experience, you know, we were learning from China, from Italy, was appropriate for the moment. But as things unfolded, we ended up sort of turning things upside down. And the way that we were, you know, managing patients, you know, in subsequent weeks was vastly different, you know, and hopefully we were getting better every day. But it was, you know, it was challenging. It was also very exciting. I mean, it's sort of never in the 25 plus years that I've been, you know, at this, did we have something changing, unfolding that quickly, and the need to sort of synthesize and digest information as it came through, and, you know, work together with colleagues and compare notes, and you know, that part of it was exciting at the same time as it was anxiety provoking.
That's so interesting, because I would imagine that somebody who goes into emergency medicine up for that kind of daily, you know, minute by minute challenge of, you know, meeting the moment, whatever it is.
Yeah, it is one of the things people who are drawn to that specialty tend to, you know, like to figure out puzzles and are okay making decisions, you know, based on, you know, sort of limited information. You know, there's other specialties where, you know, people, you know, want to gather all of the data first and sort of put together lists and do things in a very organized fashion. And emergency medicine is a little bit more MacGyver, sort of seat of the pants, you know, cowboy.
Yeah. Stuff. And everybody was making it up as we went along, because the information, yeah. I remember seeing a YouTube video that got around in, I would say, late March. And it was made by, I think he was an ER doctor in New York City, and he made it for his family, for his extended family, but then it kind of went viral. And because it was very soothing, because what he was saying at the time was, all you have to do is wash your hands and not touch your face. And he just kept on saying, like, it's really that simple.
And that's so true. And that is very true. And yes, we, you know, there was a lot of craziness too, that, you know, in among that sort of, you know, flurry and just, you know, tidal wave of information was all sorts of stuff that was, you know, having to do with, you know, being able to detect samples of virus on hard surfaces, you know, days later. So, you know, which, you know, freaked people out and, you know, made it, you know, created this paranoia about touching anything, you know, if you look at the way we do testing and sampling, and, you know, there was a lot of errors in there, and there, you know, you have to sometimes just sort of step back and that's, you know, that's hard to do. It's hard to convey that information. Atul Gawande, who does a lot of writing, you know, a surgeon at Harvard, had written a couple of things that along those lines that were, you know, looking at what happened in China with, you know, the sort of the first wave of this. Healthcare workers were dropping like flies, unfortunately, because in the very beginning, because they were not taking these, you know, the sort of necessary measures. as soon as they did, and they started wearing masks and they started, you know, doing appropriate personal protective, you know, gear and distancing, the morbidity and mortality among the healthcare workers dropped, you know, almost to zero. And that's been the case. I mean, again, these things are not 100%. This is not pure sterile aseptic technique like you have in the operating room. We try to cover up. We try to make sure the patients are covering up. We wash our hands, you know, meticulously. And you just be very conscious of what you touch and touching your face. And you can, you know, dramatically, you know, slow the spread.
Mm. One of the things I'm curious about is, I kept on thinking about people who had other emergencies during this time. You know, like what if somebody hit their head or had a heart attack, or what happened to people during that period of time where, you know, the, you know, hospitals were converted almost entirely into COVID units and people did everything they possibly could to not have to go to the hospital unless they...
That's accurate. That became a real problem, a real sort of, you know, unanticipated, you know, consequence of all the preparedness. And everything everybody was doing, you know, the social, all of the measures people were taking, and the fact that we shut everything down was, you know, to slow the spread of the virus, but in particular to avoid overwhelming the healthcare system. So that was sort of the whole focus. I think people took it to such an extreme that you know, we saw this dramatic drop in visits, in overall visits to emergency departments across the country. I mean, obviously, we all saw images of these, of, you know, Elmhurst, Queens, and places in Seattle, you know, where they were packed and overwhelmed. That was really a tiny minority. Even in New York City, many of my colleagues and, you know, described 50% reductions in overall visits to the ER. And then the word started to spread. We were comparing notes about the fact that, wait a second, where are the heart attacks? Where are the strokes? Those shouldn't have stopped happening. You know, unfortunately, people were avoiding, you know, the ER to a fault, and I'm sure there was a lot of mortality. There were, you know, and we're going to continue to see. And I mean, we have seen, you know, the effects of that. I personally have seen appendicitis that ruptured because people avoided coming to the ER. People probably had silent heart attacks or heart attacks that they attributed to indigestion or just didn't want to go to the ER. You know, and we'll end up with, you know, permanent disability as a result of that. And so a couple of weeks into this, when we were seeing this, I mean, organizations like American College of Emergency Physicians, you know, put out public service announcements saying, please don't, you know, please come, don't. And we were all taking, you know, a lot of precautions to keep things as safe and separate and sterile as possible, given the, you know, the availability of testing and the availability of PPE and stuff. But, you know, unfortunately, it was a little bit of an overreaction.
Mm-hmm.
That was very real, and you know, fortunately, part of, I think, a consequence of the fact that we had such a chaotic healthcare system in this country and sort of a lack of leadership.
Yeah, it's certainly been brought into the starkest possible relief. Connecticut has, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, but the lowest number of new COVID-19 cases in the country at this moment.
You were probably right. I trust you. I hadn't actually heard that within the last few days, but I believe it. But again, this is always made me crazy through the whole thing. You know, you got to remember that there's the denominator. I mean, we're also like the second smallest state.
We're
a pretty populous state. You know, it's a relatively large state, but it's still a relatively small number. You know, so if you're talking about absolute numbers, well sure, but it's the per capita number that sort of is more important. So I don't know exactly.
Right.
Quote you that.
Right.
But I encourage everybody to always sort of ask that question when they're saying China or you know, America has, you know, has the most number of cases. Well, you know, of course we also have the most number of people, and so, you know, what is it? What's the rate, the case per capita?
Mm-hmm. No, that's a good point. And I don't think people actually really understand that. And I think it's also creating a little bit of a sense of hubris, maybe, where my son actually forwarded me a news piece out of New Haven the other day, that they had to close down a bar because it had 1,000 people in it. And I worry about just people, we're all so longing to go back to quote unquote normal and just snap back into everything being just fine again. And I think sometimes thinking things like, you know, lowest number of cases or or just and there's no national kind of messaging about any of this. When you think about the next like year or 18 months, what do you think it's going to look like?
I certainly have no crystal ball, and I don't claim to be a an epidemiologist, or and I've been wrong other times during this whole thing. So with that caveat, certainly we flattened the curve very very effectively. We probably overall the country and each state flattened the curve and saved hundreds of thousands of lives. But the sort of an unfortunate side effect of that is that we slowed down the spread, so a relatively small number of people, have been infected, and we, whether or not infection confers immunity, we still don't know. It probably does to some extent, but we're going to be seeing subsequent waves. So there's going to be waves, and it's going to be, it's going to be regional. There's going to be outbreaks here and there. We're going to have to be shutting things down again. It may not have to be the massive across the board, thing that we had done in the past. The world is different and is going to be for the foreseeable future. The idea of people packing into stadiums and or music festivals or bars, is not going to be happening, at least until we get a vaccine and a vaccine, widely distributed. So, that's not on the horizon just yet. Hopefully within 2 years, 16 months or 2 years. I do worry a lot about the fall, as we get into the fall and winter and usual respiratory illnesses and the flu and just cold season starts, whose symptoms are very hard to distinguish from coronavirus initially, it's going to be rough in healthcare settings and just on a public health perspective.
Mm-hmm. Did you in the ER have a lot of people coming in who were anxious that they had the coronavirus and who didn't, who had just a flu or a milder or just something else?
It wasn't that bad because, we were sort of coming out of flu season. In the very beginning, it was, we were still at the tail end of flu season, so we were sort of testing everybody for flu at the same time. And again, it was pretty hard because we also didn't have available testing. I work in a number of different settings. And each place was a little bit different. And literally the protocol for who we could test and not test would change two and three times in a given shift or day, as we would run out of reagent, or we would change the lab that we would be using, or there were a lot of people very anxious about it and wanting testing, but the word got out that we weren't testing, so people weren't. We actually weren't. It wasn't like we were overwhelmed or overrun by a lot of those. Mm-hmm. Patients in the ER, and I think people were scared to death of showing up in the ER.
Right.
Around that time, I do work in some other settings. Urgent care clinics just kind of shut down, and told people you're not allowed to come in the door if you have these symptoms, and all the medical offices did. So people were, there wasn't a stampede. There was a lot of anxiety. And the anxiety still happens. The effects of just general anxiety from just, everything that's going on among patients.
Yeah. I think that's going to go on for a long time to come. There's like waves of PTSD on top of waves of the virus. So my last question for you is, it's a twofer. How are you and your colleagues taking care of yourselves during this time when it's exciting, but the flip side of exciting is it's got to be incredibly stressful? And then the second question is, what's bringing you hope?
It's tiring, and the way it has changed the way we interact with patients, having to gown and gloves and put on masks and things. You know, you can't. Part of the art of medicine was, you know, was the human touch. And you know, now just to see the look of fear on people's faces as you go into the rooms, you know, especially elderly patients or kids, you know, when you're all, you look like a spaceman. So that, you know, so anyway, that's part of the doubt. How do you deal with that? You know, we do the way we usually do. We eat pizza and drink cold coffee and have sort of gallows humor and you know, share, you know, dark, you know, jokes and camaraderie the way soldiers, I would imagine, do in war. So, you know, is that, I don't know if that's the healthy thing, but then obviously there's family, but a lot of stress has been put on that. We people are figuring out different ways. A lot of people are living in guest rooms and have, you know, not making any physical contact with their family. Or I spent 3 months, you know, in a guest house of a friend, so that I wouldn't expose my, you know, my family. And so, you know, there are resources, there are sort of mental health resources being made available, but that's also something that healthcare workers are ambivalent about accessing, because sometimes that creates a label, which can affect your credentialing and your licensing. So I don't know. I'm sorry. I wish I had a good answer. It's taking its toll on healthcare workers.
Yeah.
But you know, obviously, we also, by the same token, the outpouring of gratitude, of, you know, all the signs that you see up and down the street, the you know, the gifts of food that we get from people, cards from kids, is amazing. I mean, you know, we've never experienced that sort of show of love, and I must say it's tremendous. Mm. And really, the fact that everybody did what they did, you know, the fact that everybody put their lives on hold, you know, to the extent they did, in order to protect, you know, their local nurses and doctors and you know, healthcare workers, you know, says volume. So I think we gained a lot of sort of love and strength from that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a hopeful sign of just of, you know, the human spirit and the human condition.
Absolutely. It's, you know, and that was overwhelming. I mean, it really was. I mean, an amazing demonstration of the human spirit of goodness in people.
Mm. Well, Eric, thank you so much for taking the time to talk about all this. I think people really want to know and want to hear, you know, what's going on in all of these ways and in all of these places and with all of these people. And especially, I've had a few healthcare workers on the show, but not an ER doctor. And I'm just really glad to be able to talk to you. So thanks.
Oh, my pleasure. And again, mine is just one little perspective, you know, from one corner of the system. So, but I hope that was helpful. And thank you very much for having me here. I it's always a pleasure to talk with you, and this was fun.
Good. I'm glad. Me too. Thanks for listening to The Way We Live Now. Tell us the way you're living now. We want to hear. Call us on, you might want to get a pen for this, 909-713-8995. That's 909-713-8995. And record your story, and we might just use it on the pod. Also, you can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/thewaywelivenowpod. We are creating a community here, and we would love for you to join us. You can find me on Instagram at Danny Ryder. The Way We Live Now is a production of iHeartRadio. It's produced by Lowell Berlanti. Beth Ann Macaluso is executive producer. Special thanks to Tristan McNeil and Tyler Klang. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Hey, everyone. This is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. I've been needing a quick getaway with my family, and the 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe is the perfect vehicle to take us there. It has standard third row seating, so I'm able to pack my entire family, plus pets in the car, while also having enough room for our camping essentials. Available H-Track all-wheel drive will get us through any dirt trails, and available dual wireless charging pads will ensure we never have to worry about getting stuck with a dead phone in the middle of nowhere. Visit HyundaiUSA.com. or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200K for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does all the work for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. Visit Picasso to see thousands of listings. That's PACASO.com.